For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and coming up this week, international bestseller B.A. Paris discusses her latest psychological thriller, The Therapist. Loyal listener Penny Melville Brown introduces us to her favourite spy writer. And we continue our review of this year's Philip Carnegie shortlist with middle grade sensation Jason Reynolds. That's all coming up on today's Read On. B.A. Paris is the internationally best-selling author of Behind Closed Doors, The Breakdown, Bring Me Back, and The Dilemma, which have garnered her a reputation for writing twisty psychological thrillers that explore the secrets behind seemingly perfect lives. Her latest novel, The Therapist, is no exception. Here she is to tell us more. B.A. Paris, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me on the programme, Red.
The Therapist has just come out, and for anyone who hasn't yet picked it up, could you set the scene for us, please?
Yes. So The Therapist tells the story of Alice and Leo, who move into a gated residence in London. And they haven't been there very long before Alice discovers that something terrible happened in the house not long before they bought it. And she becomes a little bit obsessed with trying to find out why she didn't know about it, why Leo didn't tell her about this, and exactly what happened in that house and who is responsible.
And seemingly they have moved to the perfect place, a beautiful gated community in Finsbury Park. Just 16 houses and a nice green area for children to play in the middle. But behind the facade, there are more dark goings on than just the grisly secret that the house holds.
Yes, exactly. I think the reason I set it in this gated community and the houses are built in a kind of semicircle is that everybody can really see what everybody else is doing. And I quite like that kind of claustrophobic setting because you're always imagining that people are watching you, which Alice does. And when she tries to find out this secret, she tries to ask the neighbours about it, and everybody is keeping very quiet. And so, you know, she's not getting much fun with the neighbours. She wants to integrate, and I think this was another important point of my book. It's about people wanting to integrate into their kind of neighbourhood, and it's very hard for her. And people are very friendly, but behind that, she can tell that there's secrets and lies, and she doesn't know who to trust.
Yes, she's very much a country mouse transported to the town, and we always assume that the worst curtain twitching happens in country villages, but actually where we live on top of each other in cities, we're in even closer proximity.
Yes, that's very true, and that's why I wanted to set it. I wasn't sure I'd be able to get such a claustrophobic feel to the story if it was set in the countryside, where most of my books are usually set, actually. So this was new for me, moving it to London. And I did feel that, yes, this row of houses built in that semicircle is very intimate and yet very claustrophobic. And of course, in that kind of community, as soon as something goes wrong, well, everybody knows about it.
Absolutely. And you don't want to give any spoilers, but just the little secrets behind the seemingly perfect neighbours are immensely entertaining as well. All these seemingly perfect yummy mummies and city workers who are anything but once you scratch beneath the surface.
Yes, you know, I love this theme of exploring relationships and how we all think other couples are perfect and have the perfect relationship, perfect families. And, you know, the reality is that everybody has problems because that's just the way of the world. It was a theme I explored quite a lot in my other books, Behind Closed Doors. And I love that title because Behind Closed Doors, this is exactly what we're all wondering, what goes on behind the closed doors of our neighbours and friends.
There are links between all of your books. The capacity within us to be manipulated because we are trusting or naive and other people are more exploitative.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. I think that we are manipulated in all areas of our lives, really, to a certain extent by family and friends, I suppose, but by social media. And, you know, we're always told that things are going to be perfect if we do this or that, exercise more, eat less of this. We are manipulated all the time in our everyday lives. And then when it happens by somebody closer to home, somebody that you live with or a neighbour, that's all the more frightening.
And both Alice and Grace
the protagonist of Behind Closed Doors, have trust issues that are exploited by others because things have happened in their past that means that they cleave to people they feel they can trust, and that can turn very nasty. When Alice starts thinking that there might be somebody in the house at night, it plays on all those fears that grow from our childhood of when our parents close the door and wish us good night.
That's right. Is there somebody under the bed or in the wardrobe? I remember having to check under the children's beds for them before I left the room because they'd want me to make sure there was nobody hiding under them. So, yes, it does play on all our fears. I think, you know, one of our greatest fears is somebody breaking into our house at night and not hearing them come in and just waking up and they're there in the bedroom, or to wake up the next morning, which has happened to friends of mine, and find that somebody has been in the house and stolen things, moved things around, and they haven't even been aware of it because they were fast asleep upstairs. So it's really frightening, this invasion of personal space. And when at first you're not sure it's really happening, you think it must be your imagination, or you're not really aware, it doesn't really twig that something funny is going on. When you actually realise that there is somebody there, that somebody is breaking into the house, it's all the more frightening.
Indeed. And this has really struck a chord with readers around the world. Behind Closed Doors sold 500,000 copies worldwide in just 3 months. And you get quite a lot of fan mail from women who have been gaslighted, who say that you have caught exactly their experience.
Yes, I think that was one of the most amazing things. When I wrote Behind Closed Doors, I didn't expect to get the feedback that I got. And it was really humbling to get messages from women who said that reading Behind Closed Doors had enabled them to leave their abusive relationship because they could see how Grace had done it. It wasn't so much they were going to do it the same way as Grace, but it just gave them the courage to say, yes, actually, I am being abused by my husband. This is psychological manipulation, and I am going to leave. One woman had read both my first two books, and the second book, The Breakdown, explores a similar theme. And she said, you know, just reading those two books, she said, I've now left my husband and, you know, I'm doing well. It's hard, but it's much easier than being with him. So all that kind of thing. I think it kind of struck a chord with women and made them realise maybe that they were being manipulated and they hadn't realised it.
As we drive to Millie's school on Sunday morning, I'm so stressed about why Mrs. Goodrich has asked to see us that it's a relief Jack didn't bring me breakfast before leaving. He didn't bring any food yesterday either, which means I've had nothing to eat since lunch in the restaurant on Friday. I don't know why he chose not to feed me, but it was probably because Esther helped me finish my dessert, which he would consider as cheating, knowing all too well that I wouldn't have been able to eat it after the reference he made to Millie's bedroom. In the sick world that Jack has created for me, there are many things I'm not allowed to do. And wasting food is one of them. My heart starts hammering as soon as we're ushered into Mrs. Goodrich's office, especially when Janice sits down with us, her face grave. We haven't seen Millie yet, so I presume that she doesn't know Jack and I are already here. But I needn't have worried. All they want to tell us is that because she's been having trouble sleeping, which makes her irritable during the day, the school doctor has prescribed something to calm her before bedtime. Do you mean sleeping pills? I ask. Yes, Mrs. Goodrich says. To be administered, with your permission, of course, as and when she needs them.
Georgia McGuire, narrating Behind Closed Doors, written by my guest, B.A. Paris. I've read interviews with you, and I know that you are very happily married and brought up a large family before turning to writing when you were 50 years old. Where does the inspiration for these twisty, dark psychological plots come from?
I think I've always had a really vivid imagination. I'm the kind of person, I'm very optimistic, but I do imagine the worst could happen. So, you know, if my daughter leans out of the window, I immediately think she's going to fall. So I'm quite a nervous mother. I'm quite nervous, but I always can see what could go wrong. And I think that that has really helped me in writing books, because the start of my books is always something that I think could happen to me, or I'll just have that thought, what if? And for the therapist, we had just moved back to England after many years in France, and we moved into a cottage, which is quite old. And I remember thinking a lot of people must have died here. And that was fine. I was happy to live with their ghosts. And then I thought, what if somebody had been murdered here? And what if it happened really recently and I hadn't known until I moved in? And that's when I began to think, actually, that's a really good start for a book, because how would people feel? And it's interesting because some people I spoke to have said, actually, it wouldn't really bother me if somebody had been murdered in the house 18 months before. I don't think I'd be very happy about it, and I think some people wouldn't be, but I thought it was a great start for a story. And so my books always come around from that. And then, of course, any research I have to do can be done online, because sometimes it's just not possible to do it any other way. So, you know, for Behind Closed Doors, I've had numerous articles about women who had been kept prisoner more or less by their husbands. But yes, my starting point is always something that I think could happen to me.
So are you the kind of person who lies awake at 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, what if, and then scribble it down onto your laptop the next morning?
Yes, sometimes I do. Sometimes I have an idea in the middle of the night, and I do that. You know, I'll get my computer. But normally it's something to do with the story I'm writing at the time. I might think of a plot twist, because when I'm right in the middle of writing a book, you know, it's always in my mind. I'm only about 50% present in my everyday life, because the rest of it is always on my book. So I sleep quite badly at night because I'm always thinking about my books. So yes, I will get up and write a new plot line and just think, I'll have to write this down now in case I forget in the morning.
I believe you always wanted to be a writer, but actually it was one of your daughters who pushed you into entering a competition.
Yes, that's right. My daughters knew I wanted to write, but actually I always wanted to write children's stories because I used to make up stories for my children. And right from an early age, since I was about 7 years old, I always thought one day I'll write stories for children. And it's funny because my daughter had an idea for a novel and I saw this competition in the Sunday Times. So I told her, I said, look, you should write your novel, you know, and enter this competition. But she was only 16 and you had to be 18. So she said, why don't you write a novel you want to write? And I said to her, I could never write 80,000 words. You know, when I start writing, it'll be children's stories. And she said, you should try. And I went to bed that night and I had an idea, not for Behind Closed Doors. It was a completely different book about a family, which hasn't been published and it didn't win the competition. But once I started writing, I just could not stop. It was like a drug. It was quite incredible, I think, for my family, quite difficult, because I'd gone from being this mother who was there picking them up at the school gates, taking them home, spending time with them. I'd always made loads of cakes. And suddenly, you know, they were coming home and I was at the computer and I was hardly speaking to them because I just was obsessed with writing. And it was like that for about 6 months and then I calmed down. And I haven't stopped since. So, yeah, I think it's really strange that you can come to something, have this huge passion later in life. But it was thanks to my daughter. I'll always be very grateful that she pushed me into writing a novel.
Has she taken up the pen herself?
No, I mean, she's still got that idea for the novel, but she wants me to write it for her. So, but, you know, I've got too many ideas and she'll just have to do it herself. I don't know whether she ever will. Maybe she will. Maybe she'll, when she's 50 years old like me, she'll start writing because she might have more time then. Because I do think it's a question of time. I really admire young authors who, you know, might have young families and everything. For me, I felt that it was just a case of waiting for the right time. I never thought I'll start writing when I'm 50 years old. It was just that that happened to be the right time for me because two of my daughters had left home to go to university, so that loosened up a little bit of time for me. And I don't think I would be the same author if I'd started writing when I was 30, maybe.
You have also been remarkably prolific. You're writing a novel a year at the moment.
Yes, I think a lot of authors of psychological thrillers do. That's kind of quite standard in the industry, I think. And actually, it's quite good. I take about 6 months to write a novel, maybe, and then there's all the edits to do. So one every year means quite a lot of work, but when you love it and when you find a theme or a story that you like and you're enjoying writing, it just becomes a pleasure, really. Of course, there are moments when it's hard, but yes, and I'm very aware that, you know, I did start writing at 50, so I do want to get another few novels out there before I decide, oh gosh, I'm tired now, I don't want to do this anymore. So I do want to maintain that one novel a year.
And I think one of the things that makes your books so compelling and maybe helps with the pace of writing them, I don't know, is that you write short chapters so that the reader is always just thinking, oh, just one more before I go to sleep.
That came about quite naturally. I think I remember my agent saying to me that actually short chapters are good because especially when people read on Kindles now and they just get blocks of writing. So it's good to separate it out with paragraphs and to have quite short chapters. And actually, I struggle when chapters are very long in books because you do kind of set yourself, I'll read a chapter and then I'll go and do this. But if the chapter goes on for 30 or 40 pages, you are thinking more, when am I going to get to the end of this chapter, rather than enjoying the story. So, yes, I think, you know, short chapters are the way to go, and trying to have that kind of cliffhanger almost at the end of a chapter so that people just say, oh, actually, I'm going to read another one, and then another one.
The Therapist is also available as an audiobook, which is read by two narrators, Olivia Dowd, who voices Alice, and Thomas Judd, who narrates the unknown therapist, who is revealing the mystery from the other side. Was it important for you to have the book made into an audiobook as well?
Yes, I mean, I think audiobooks are great. I mean, there's so many people that listen to audiobooks now, and I do when I'm walking along. I like walking, so I'll always have an audiobook. And yes, it's great that we can have our books on audio now, and that gets to so many more people. So yes, it was important for me, and it's lovely just listening to it. I don't listen to the whole book because I'm usually too busy, but you know, I do like to check. But we were always given a couple of voices to choose from, and so, you know, you pick your voices and say, yeah, I think this will be right for that character. But yeah, I think audiobooks are just amazing because so many people don't have time to actually sit with a book now.
And Olivia Dowd really captures that vulnerability and slightly obsessive nature that Alice has.
Yes, and I think she's obsessive. And of course, a lot of readers will say, why is she obsessed? But I think, you know, all ties in with the end of the book when you realise that she is very vulnerable. And, you know, she is flawed. All my characters are flawed because we are all flawed and nobody wants to read about somebody who's completely perfect. But yes, she is obsessive. It's true. She becomes obsessed by this murder, which has actually nothing to do with her in a way, because she lives in the house where it happened. But that's about it. She really wants to uncover it. And it, for lots of reasons. And this becomes clear at the end. And I think that's when we can be a little bit forgiving that she was so obsessive about the murder.
Here, in the circle, everything is silent. Even with the windows open, there's been only the occasional sound. It isn't what I was expecting, which I guess is a good thing. From the upstairs window in Leo's study, I look down to the road outside. A woman with a white blonde pixie cut, wearing shorts and a vest top, is hugging another woman. Tall, slim, with coppery red hair. I know the smaller woman is our neighbour. I saw her late last night outside number 5, pulling suitcases from the back of a car with a man. The other woman I haven't seen before, but she looks as if she belongs here, with her perfectly fitting navy jeans and crisp white t-shirt hugging the contours of her toned upper body. I should move away, because if they look up at the house, they might see me standing here. But my need for company is too strong, so I stay where I am. I was going to call in on the way back from my run, I promise, the small woman is saying. The tall woman shakes her head, but there's a smile in her voice. Not good enough, Eve. I was expecting you yesterday. Eve, so that's her name. Laughs. It was 10 in the evening by the time we arrived, way too late to disturb you. When did you get back? Saturday, in time for the children going back to school today.
Olivia Dowd, narrating The Therapist, written by my guest, B.A. Paris. Now, one thing that blind readers will not be able to appreciate is the cover of The Therapist. Can you describe it for us?
Yes, the cover of The Therapist is, I think, probably my favourite cover out of my 5 books. It's bright red, not pillar box red. It's a lovely red. And on the cover, it has a rose, a white rose, and it's slightly wilted. So it's got a beautiful head on it, but it's just kind of falling over to the right-hand side, as if it's slightly wilting. And I think this wants to represent that not all is perfect in what you're going to read inside, that this is a book that things might on the outside seem wonderful, but inside there's things going on.
Do you have any connections to sight loss yourself?
Only with my parents. So my father's 97, and he reads the newspaper now with a huge magnifying glass. And I'm desperately trying to find large print books for my mother because she can't read a normal paperback now. So, you know, to be visually impaired, it must be just so difficult. And that's why it's just so brilliant to have these books now that are available to everybody and everybody can enjoy them.
And have they discovered the joys of audiobooks yet?
Well, you know, because of their ages, they're just not used to it. So they'll sit and listen to music, but I think it would have to be a book that both of them would enjoy, and that's quite hard because they have very different tastes. They have listened to my books on audio, so hopefully they'll start listening to some more.
Well, there's a wealth of talking books in the RNIB library awaiting them should they ever decide to do so, including quite a few of yours.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So I'm guessing that you have already started writing the next novel.
Yes, I've just finished it and I love this one. I mean, probably I say that about all my books, but I'm not sure because I think you love them till the point where they go out into the wide world and then you're always really worried about what people's reaction are going to be to them because people say it's like putting your child out there and hoping everybody finds it beautiful. But I do love my next one. It's really hard with psychological thrillers to find a twist and to keep readers entertained. And there are so many good psychological thriller writers out there. So it's hard to find something. But I think in my next book, I really have found something that is a little bit different. So I'm really excited about this book and it will be published sometime next year.
And hopefully you will come back at the end of the show to share some of the books that you have enjoyed in your life.
Yes, thank you. I'd love to do that.
In the meantime, B.A. Paris, thank you so much for taking us into the dark world of The Therapist and for sharing some insights into your life as an author.
Thank you, Red. Thank you for having me on the programme. I've really enjoyed it.
The Therapist joins other titles by B.A. Paris, including Behind Closed Doors, in the RNIB library. And Bernadette will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
The current times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come this week, Jason Reynolds introduces us to Look Both Ways, a tale told in 10 blocks. But first,
Penny Melville Brown is a retired naval commander and the founder of Disability Dynamics and Baking Blind, both of which seek to highlight the capabilities of blind and other disabled people. She's also an avid bookworm with a serious audiobook habit, and she's kindly agreed to record a series of book reviews for RNIB Connect Radio. Penny, welcome back. I believe you're going to take us back into the world of espionage.
Yes, and I'm going to talk to you today just about one author who is an absolute favourite of mine. I've been reading his books since the 1960s, and when I say I've been reading them, I reread nearly all of them about every 5 years. And this author is Len Deighton. Everybody's heard about John le Carré and Smiley's People and that wonderful character. Len Deighton is an absolute contemporary of John le Carré, and I think even better. The first three stories that he wrote was The Ypres File, which of course was a fabulous film with Michael Caine starring as Harry Palmer. The second book in the series is Horse Underwater. And this is all about a salvage operation off the Portuguese coast, and it's all set in the Cold War. And one of the things that I really loved is that part of it at the very beginning is set at the naval establishment HMS Vernon in Portsmouth. And 15 years after the book was written, I was there at HMS Vernon when I joined the Navy. And now that I've been able to get this book on audio, I've been able to reread it, and I recognise lots of the characters and the types that he was portraying in the book. And it is just super. And of course, I'm talking about him writing in the 1960s. By the end of the 1970s, I was in an intelligence job in NATO in Naples. So all of this has got very close links with me and my life.
Marrakesh is just what the guidebooks say it is. Marrakesh is an ancient walled city surrounded with olive groves and palm trees. Behind it rise the mountains of the High Atlas, and in the city, the marketplace at Jemaa Khafna is alive with jugglers, dancers, magicians, storytellers, snake charmers and music. Marrakesh is a fairy tale city. But on this trip, I didn't get to see much more of it than a fly-blown hotel room and the immobile faces of three Portuguese politicians.
James Lely narrating Horse Underwater by Len Dayton, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And Harry Palmer came back in a third book after that, didn't he?
He did. Well, actually, he's never named in the books themselves. It's only in the films with Michael Caine that he's named as Harry Palmer. And this third one was Funeral in Berlin. And it's amazing how it takes you back. And I think the thing that really struck me is the reliance on coal fires. And here they are in these little sort of terraced houses from which they're running their spy empires. And they all have scuttles of coal and they light fires. And you think how completely different is life and yet how similar some of the problems we still face. And the other thing that struck me was the Queen gets a brief mention in that book. And you think the changes that that woman has seen throughout her life are just staggering. But it's a great book, and I really recommend it.
It was one of those artificially hot days that they used to call Indian summer. It was no time to be paying a call to Bina Gardens in southwest London, if there was a time for it. Outside the house I sought, there was a bright card tied to the railings with green twine. On it, in large exact capitals, was penned, "Lost, Siamese cat. Answers to the name Confucius." Answers what? I walked up the steps where the sun was warming up a pint of Jersey and a banana flavour yoghurt. Tucked behind the bottles, a Daily Mail peeped its headline. Berlin, a new crisis. There were buttons on that doorpost, like on a pearly king's hat, but only one said Robin J. Hallam, FRSA, in a flowing copper plate. That was the one I pressed. "You haven't seen Confucius?" "No," I said. "I only missed him last night." "Really?" I said, feigning warm interest.
James Lely narrating Funeral in Berlin by Len Dayton, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Len Dayton wrote far more than the Harry Palmer books, didn't he?
Absolutely, and he's probably best known for the Bernie Sampson books, Berlin Game, London Set, and all the rest of them. There are 9 books in that series, and those were made into a television series, a BBC series, starring the late Ian Holm, before he became famous as Bilbo Baggins. You could tell how enthusiastic I am about Len Dayton. What he was also famous for, he started writing actually as a cookery writer, so he's got other links with me and my baking blind activities. But he was very well known as a great historian of the Second World War, particularly around aircraft. So his books, Fighter, Bomber, Goodbye Mickey Mouse, all excellent reads. But I want to take us on to another book now called SSGB. This is his imagination of Britain once it was occupied by the Nazis soon into the war, because obviously the Battle of Britain and all of that didn't work and we were occupied. And it's a story about a British police officer and how he's coping to work with the Germans and work in Britain and the sort of conflict of interests that he has. And there's underlying themes about the potential atomic bomb, about the UK resistance, and about all the internecine battles within the German occupation forces. It's a very complicated plot, really worth a read. It's a completely different take on where the war might have taken us if we hadn't succeeded. And again, I strongly recommend it.
The beer seemed to get weaker every day. And anyone who believed those stories about the fighting having destroyed the hop fields had never tasted the export brands that were selling in German soldiers' canteens. In spite of its limitations, Douglas poured a second pint and smothered the tasteless cheese sandwich with mustard before eating it. There were several other murder squad officers in the Red Lion in Derby Gate. It was Scotland Yard's own pub. More crimes had been solved in this bar than in all the offices, path labs and record offices put together. Or so some of the regulars claimed after a few drinks.
James Lely again, narrating SSGB by Len Dayton, which is available from the RNIB library.
Virtually all Len Dayton's books are super.
And virtually all of them are available from the RNIB Talking Books library.
I bet you haven't got the cookery book.
A gap that needs to be filled. Penny Melville-Brown, thank you for taking us through the wonderful back catalogue of Len Dayton novels and for sharing your joy of reading with the listeners. And just a reminder, if people want to catch up with the latest developments with Baking Blind and your COVID cookbook, whereabouts can they find details?
Well, they're on my blog, but probably easiest on my Facebook page, which is, surprisingly, Penny Melville hyphen Brown.
And that's three L's in Melville.
There are.
Thanks again to Penny Melville Brown.
A gift in your will is a really special way to continue supporting RNIB. Large or small, all gifts can have a huge impact on our services, as our work is vital and our services are needed more than ever. Over a third of the work we do is funded by the generosity of supporters who leave a gift in their will to RNIB. If you leave a legacy, you will make a significant difference to the lives of blind and partially sighted people, so their future is full of opportunity. Creating a will offers you the chance to make sure the people and causes you care about most are supported for years to come. We've made it easier for you to write or update your will with our free, accessible and simple will writing services. To find out more, please call 0303 123 9999 or go to rnib.org.uk/legacy.
This is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to B.A. Paris to share the books of her life, last month, the shortlist for this year's Philip Carnegie Medal was announced. The award is the world's oldest prize recognising excellence in children's literature, and the list of former winners includes many of the best-loved children's authors of all time. This year's shortlist includes two former winners and reveals explorations of freedom, the great outdoors, and grief to be key recurring themes. The result will be announced on the 16th of June, and before that, Read On aims to bring you interviews with all the shortlisted authors. This week, it's the turn of Jason Reynolds. The first time we met Jason was back in 2019, when he was also shortlisted for the Carnegie Medal for his breathtaking novel Long Way Down, which examined the complexities of teenage lives blighted by gang violence. And now he's back with Look Both Ways, which is an equally compelling reflection on the walk home from school. Before we hear from him, here's a clip.
It started back when Satchmo was bit. He was 7 years old, and the Rottweiler was 32 years old, which was old enough for him to know better, Satchmo had thought. The dog had taken a chunk out of the back of Satchmo's leg, left teeth marks that scarred in the shape of a sad face. It was a freak accident, a moment that no one could have predicted, because Satchmo Jenkins never, ever missed. Whenever a ball was thrown toward him, he was sure to snatch it from the air. He was known for this. But when Clancy had told him to go long and heave the football into the air, Satchmo had tried his best to extend his body, stretched out for it, but it was just beyond him. Overthrown. And when the ball hit the ground, it took the worst possible bounce right into Miss Adams's yard, where Brutus the Rottweiler lived, chained to a tree. When the ball tumbled Brutus's way, he jumped up, tail like a stubby index finger wagging hard enough to knock him off balance, nosed the ball and tried to get his mouth around it, tried to get his teeth locked down on the pigskin. But Brutus's excitement got the best of him, and he ended up knocking the ball just past the length of the chain restraining him. Perfect for Satchmo.
Jason, welcome back to Read On, and many congratulations.
Thank you so much, man. It's good to be here.
You must be delighted. Or are you getting a bit jaded with all these literary awards that you keep being put forward for?
No, man. I'm not jaded at all. I mean, honestly, anytime anyone recognizes something that I've done, you never get used to it. I never want to get used to that. I'm always grateful. I'm always surprised. And yeah, it still feels like the first time, you know?
One of my friends who gave his reluctant reader son a copy of Look Both Ways said that your secret is making the everyday very interesting and not choosing something that kids feel separated from, not putting them in the middle of some magic forest. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's funny that he said that. I mean, that's really my whole thing. Here's the thing. I understand the idea of creating magical worlds, right? I do. And for all my friends and colleagues who write fantasy and to all the readers who read fantasy, like, I take my hat off because I do understand the idea of escapism and creating magical worlds. What I want to do, though, is shine a light on the magic that exists in the world that we live in, right? I think that we actually all live pretty magical lives. We just don't pay attention to it anymore because it's the lives that we lead every day. But I actually think there's a lot of magic happening around us regularly that I try to put on the page in a way to remind us that, like, actually the banality of our lives, the mundane of it all, is actually where the magic is.
And in Look Both Ways, you pick something that is universal to all of us who went to school, the walk back from school to home.
Yeah, I hadn't really seen a lot of it. You know, it's like when you read kids' books, either they're at home or they're at school. And I wanted to show that this liminal space is actually one of the rare spaces of freedom for young people. It's one of the rare times that they actually get to be autonomous and to have agency and get to be their whole selves without the supervision of adults. And I think there's so much to play around with there. There's so many opportunities there. There's so much possibility there. That's the reason I wanted to sort of write all these stories about this strange and hilarious and sometimes heart-wrenching liminal space between school and home.
And you take 10 different stories, 10 different themes, and explore them. There's bullying, there's kids who've got sick parents, and one that particularly chimed with me as a kid who was terrified of dogs, Satchmo's story.
You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where Satchmo was a real dog that existed. You know, like, that's really based on me. And then my neighborhood, I had a dog named Satchmo was up the street from me, and then a dog named Jazz was on a block over, and neither of them were ever on the leash and always kind of running free. And it was frightening because one was an Akita and one was a German Shepherd. I look back now and I realize that these dogs were just playful. But when you're young and you're walking home from school and suddenly a dog starts barking and chasing you, you can only think of one thing, which is this dog is trying to bite me, especially because I lived in a neighborhood where people had dogs as guard dogs. So we never assumed the dog could do two things, that it could guard the house and still be a playful animal. And so it really was a frightening experience for me. And I was afraid, even though I had dogs of my own, and I still was afraid because of Satchmo and because of Jazz and some of the other dogs in my neighborhood. It's a very real thing. But that fear is oftentimes a fear that exists in our heads, you know. I mean, you deal with animals, you realize that once you put your hand out, most of the time, that tail is wagging, that dog is not interested in eating you.
He just wants to play with that nice ball that's been dropped in front of him and that you have to go back and get.
That's it. He just wants to play, you know, like children do. And that's the other parallel to this, right, is that to think about that story from a macro level, it's also saying the kids that we see walking home, especially if you live in a major city and anywhere in this world, you know, they might seem a certain way. They might talk a certain way. They might be barking. But most of the time, these kids ain't trying to bite you, right? Like, they're just children. They're just playful. And I think that's sort of the parallel between that and that story that doesn't get talked about often. But that's really what the story is sort of getting at, that, like, with who this boy is and who our children are and who this dog is and what he thinks of this dog is no different than what many of us think of our children. That they're scary, that they're unruly, that they're coming for us. When really it's like, I just am trying to be a child. I just want you to pet me. I mean, that's sort of the point.
That's a major theme running through this book and all your work. You don't take things at face value. You want to look behind the facade so that we see the girl on the skateboard who is being bullied, but actually we then get a glimpse into her bully's backstory. And we realise that it's not so easy just to say they're a bad child. They've got damage too.
Exactly. And I think, you know, when it comes to kids, especially as we deal with children and all human beings, but especially as we deal with children, I just think it's important that we extend a little grace. It doesn't mean that we have to strip anyone of accountability, but it does mean that, like, but if a child is treating another child a certain way, usually it's because an adult in their lives have failed them. And that's the part we never want to talk about, right? So we chastise this child for being a bully, but we never ask ourselves what adult in this child's life has already failed them or has shown them something that's caused them to turn away and to become this way. Nobody is naturally mean. Nobody is bad, right? That's not a thing, especially as it pertains to kids. Bad things happen to them. And their response to that is to inflict that. You have to get that pain. You have to transfer that energy somewhere. And it usually is them taking it out on somebody else that they deem to be weaker in some way, shape, or form. Right? And that's what you see in that story. He knew that he was coming from a complicated household. And so all he could do was what he knew. This whole book is just about humanizing our children and humanizing each other.
You do that most successfully in the story of the Lowcuts. Could you tell the listeners a bit more about that?
Yeah, the Lowcuts are these four kids. They're like a crew. I'm always careful about calling them a gang. They're just a crew of kids, they're a group of friends, you know? And they are known for being sort of pickpockets, for being stick-up kids. They just kind of take whatever spare change they can find, whether it be out of the pocket of people, whether it be, you know, shaking kids down, whether it be out of the corners of the hallways, wherever they can get it, they get spare change. And so you immediately buy into this fact that these are the troubled kids. Right. And then you see them sort of go to a candy lady's house. I grew up with the candy lady. A lot of people in America, I'm not sure if it's like this in the UK, but we grow up in these neighborhoods where there's always an older lady who sells candy on your block. Right. And you go to the candy lady and they basically are trying to figure out how to use this change to get candy from the candy lady, only so that they can then go to the pool hall and hustle this candy and flip the candy to make more money. Now, in any other circumstance, this would almost be equivalent to the way that hustlers hustle drugs, right? You buy it low, you flip it high, right? And it's a hustle. These are little kids who are sort of moving in this interesting space, almost as if they were part of some organized crime ring. And then you realize that what they're really doing is they're trying to get enough money to go to the ice cream truck to get ice cream, not for themselves, right? That would have been a cute story to tell. It's like, oh, they just went to ice cream. It's like, no, they actually have gone to get ice cream so that they can give it to one of their friend's moms who is dealing with a second bout of cancer and has gone through her first round of chemo. And this is to cut the nausea, because all these kids have had parents who have suffered in some shape, way, or form from cancer. And so they understand what to do and how to do it and why it is necessary. It's a story about love and about how we don't always make the right decisions, but our intentions are oftentimes the right intentions. And I love that story. That's been the standout for a lot of, it's not my favorite story in the book, but it's a lot of people's favorite story.
I felt dizzy when you flipped my perception at that moment where you give the reveal. I didn't feel I'd so much been misled as I had just made an easy assumption. And that's a glorious moment for a writer to know that they can do that. And it's quite revealing when you're as long in the tooth as I am and can still be wrong-footed by an author.
I mean, look, that's always the goal. I mean, and I'm glad you said you didn't feel fooled or like, because I don't like that, right? I didn't want it to feel like a bait and switch. I just wanted to feel like you haven't gotten to the end of the story yet. You made your assumptions based on biases, but you actually haven't gotten to the end of the story. Let's hear these kids out. Let's follow it all the way through. And I think that's what we all have to do regularly, is remind ourselves, before I make an assumption, let me follow it all the way through. Let me see. Let me go all the way down the road to see what exactly is happening, instead of just thin slicing and making a snap judgment.
I was also struck by how precarious the self-belief of so many of these kids is. They are in the middle. They are little big people. They're not kids. They've got hormones, but they're not yet adults. And they're walking quite a tightrope.
You know, it's funny. When I was a kid, they'd say, you're an old soul, or, you know, you're mature for your age. And then you realize as you get older that a 13-year-old is a 13-year-old, right? like that, no matter what that 13-year-old has seen, that has turned that 13-year-old into maybe an older version of a 13-year-old. A 13-year-old is still a 13-year-old. There are still things that 13-year-old don't, that they just can't know. And there are going to be moments where that 13-year-old shows themselves as a 13-year-old. A prime example of this is that if you've ever been to a juvenile detention center, these kids are experiencing something that most kids don't experience, and that's incarceration. But when they come in the room, there's no way you can see them as anything other than 12-year-olds. No matter how tough they are, no matter how they stick out their chest, no matter how they screw up their faces, there's no way you can look at them and see anything other than a 12-year-old in that moment, because that's what they actually are. And that's what I wanted to show, that yes, these kids, some of them are a little more mature than others, but the reality is that there's always a crack in that armor and you realize, ah, this is still just a kid.
Is that why you're drawn again and again to this middle grade age group for your writing?
I think so. You know, it's funny because I started writing as in YA. There's something about the middle grade age that it feels a little more open, because at that age, they're just asking questions. The entire world's a question mark. And because of that, I can play around. I can run around, right? I can do what I want. It's a big playground. It's a big sandlot, because they know some things, but they have more questions than they have answers, right? And so their whole lives are about like what, how, who, when, where. Their bodies are changing, and so there's a natural discomfort and an awkwardness to them. The skin is tight. Like all these things that happen, their hormones are raging. They're dealing with like hygiene. If there's going to be divorce, it's usually around this time, which causes all kinds of other wrenches in the plan. And I don't know. It's just a sweet spot when it comes to storytelling.
Another outstanding story, which certainly rang a few bells with the teenage me, was the boy trying to summon up courage and scrub himself up nicely to ask a girl for her phone number.
Yeah, man, I love that story. One of the things that I always want to do in my work is subvert the idea of masculinity. So like in everything I've written, no matter what it is, I mean, that you're always going to see a boy being put in a vulnerable space. And the power dynamics of young life, the girl is always sort of in control. I don't write damsels ever, right? Like, it's not a thing that because I didn't grow up around damsels. I didn't know any. Like, I don't know who those young girls are. I'm sure they exist, but they weren't in my life. And so it's hard for me to even imagine a quote unquote weak girl or a vulnerable girl. Not that young girls aren't vulnerable, obviously. But for me, I think what I want to portray is men, boys who are vulnerable, so that young girls can be vulnerable in a safe way. Right. And so you take a character like this kid. He's not cool. He doesn't have any bravado. He doesn't have any machismo. He doesn't have any swagger. He doesn't even know how to like keep himself together with his hygiene. But he trusts his friends. And they're doing what they know, the best that they know, right? But they're kids. So it's like, hey, put this on your face. Put this, spray this cologne on your body. Put this, you know, it's like, spruce yourself up a little bit. You know, we're going to be here as your support system as he goes and he tries to get this girl's phone number. And I like the fact that you don't know if she gives it to him or not, because she doesn't owe it to him. She doesn't have to give him her phone number just because he showed up and asked for it, just because he spruced himself up. She doesn't have to do any of that. And I think all of those elements are just really important to portray.
The stories are interlinked. So we have the lingering smell of the body spray that he's used that other kids then walk through. And it just shows that the school is a community of lots of individuals, all of whom have a story to tell. And it's the hub from which they all radiate out to very different parts of the city.
Exactly. The school serves as sort of this nexus, right? This is the crossroad where all these young people meet and they all share space. And I think this is sort of the most interesting thing about school, is that while we're in school, we're all on the same level, right? Maybe we're on, you know, academically it might be a little bit different, but we're all sharing the same space. But when school is over, we all splinter out and everybody's life becomes immediately different. Immediately, all of our lives are thrusted into different narratives as we take our journeys home to wherever and whatever home might be. And there's something about that that I think about often when I'm around kids or when I'm around my friends or when I'm in any space where I'm like, okay, in this moment, all of us are on one accord, but it does not mean that I know you. It does not mean that I know what lies beneath. It does not mean that I should assume that you and I are the same or that we're going through the same things just because we share a couple of hours a day together, like whether it be a workplace, whether it be school, whether it be a sports team, like whatever it is, like you and I can't assume that I know everything about you because we share a common space for a few hours, because when we walk out of here, we take different paths, and that has to be honored and respected. Teachers only know students for the most part on this sort of surface layer. But the truth is that if you understood what happens after that bell rang, you'd understand why that kid acts the way that kid acts in class. And that's just an interesting thing to think about.
And you also reflect that in the audiobook by having selected an ensemble of narrators, different narrators, each telling their own stories, including you.
Yeah, I wanted it to feel like a TV show, man. I wanted it to feel like an experience, you know, like theater, where almost like everyone was almost giving like a monologue, even though it's all in third person. But I wanted it to feel dramatic and interesting. Audiobooks are just incredible, but they only work if they're good. It's hard to listen to an audiobook if the narrator isn't good. And so we wanted to put together like just an entire listening experience with this, including myself, right? You know, doing the last story and bringing in the anchor and being the glue to connect all those stories and that being my voice. All that I thought was just super important, and I'm just really, really proud of it.
The whole collection is a great read, and certainly my overwhelming feeling when I put it down at the end was one of great hope in that middle grade generation. Jason Reynolds, thank you so much for making me question my own perceptions again.
My pleasure, man. I appreciate you.
Look Both Ways by Jason Reynolds is out now in print, ebook, and that amazing audiobook version, which is narrated by an ensemble cast, including Jason himself. Now it's back to B.A. Paris for the books of her life.
Bernadette, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Absolutely. I remember the book. It was the first book I ever owned, and I was in bed with measles, and I must have been 6 or 7 years old, and my mother went down to the local shop, and she came back with The Mountain of Adventure by Enid Blyton. And I had never read a book on my own before. My father would read to me, I think. I mean, I could read. I learned to read really early, but it was the first book, and I remember her giving it to me, and I just, you know, was lost in this book. I wasn't in bed with measles. I was actually on the mountain. And I absolutely loved it. And I finished it in about 2 hours. And my mother went back down to the shop and bought me The Circus of Adventure. And that was my love for reading started then. So, yes, The Mountain of Adventure by Enid Blyton, I'll always remember as the book that got me into reading.
Four children were singing at the tops of their voices in a car that was going up a steep mountainside road. A parrot was also joining in, very much out of tune, cocking up her crest in excitement. The man at the wheel turned round with a grin. I say, I can't even hear the car hooter. What's the matter with you all? Philip, Jack, Dinah and Lucy Ann stopped singing and shouted answers at him. It's the beginning of the holes, and we're going to have a donkey each to ride in the mountains. Pop goes the weasel. That was Kiki the parrot, of course, joining in. We've got 8 weeks of fun all together. And you'll be with us, Bill, as well as Mother. Mother, aren't you excited too? Mrs. Mannering smiled at Philip. Yes, but I hope you're not going to be as noisy as this all the time.
Lucy Tregear narrating The Mountain of Adventure by Enid Blyton, which is available from the R&IB Library. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, I mean, I would love that. I can just imagine a rainy day, but on a rainy day, and if I do have time to read, it's always usually psychological thrillers because that's what I read as part of my job now. But if it was that rainy day where I could just read what I wanted, I'd probably go back and read an Agatha Christie because, like Enid Blyton, you know, Agatha Christie formed my love for reading and for psychological thrillers. So, you know, just the thought of having all her books next to me and just being able to curl up with a blanket on a rainy day and delve back into these books that just captured my imagination when I was 11 or 12, I would love to do that. I haven't reread any of them since, so that would be my choice. And probably I'd start with And Then There Were None, because I think that was the first Agatha Christie book that I read.
In the corner of a first-class smoking carriage, Mr. Justice Wargrave, lately retired from the bench, puffed at a cigar and ran an interested eye through the political news in the Times. He laid the paper down and glanced out of the window. They were running now through Somerset. He glanced at his watch, another 2 hours to go. He went over in his mind all that had appeared in the papers about Soldier Island. There had been its original purchase by an American millionaire who was crazy about yachting, and an account of the luxurious modern house he had built on this little island off the Devon coast. The unfortunate fact that the new third wife of the American millionaire was a bad sailor had led to the subsequent putting up of the house and island for sale. Various glowing advertisements of it had appeared in the papers. Then came the first bald statement that it had been bought by a Mr. Owen. After that, the rumours of the gossip writers had started.
Dan Stevens, narrating And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie, which is available from the RNIB Library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend to the Read On listeners?
Yes, absolutely. My favourite book of last year. I absolutely love it. It's called We Begin at the End by Chris Whittaker. And I read this towards the end of last year, and it's just beautiful. The prose is amazing. And if anything has made me aspire to be a better writer, it's reading that book, because his description is absolutely amazing. And the story is great. It tells the story of a young girl called Duchess, and it's brilliant. So I highly recommend anybody to read that book, or to listen to it if you have it in your library, which I hope you do.
Walk stood at the edge of a feverish crowd, some he'd known since his birth, some since theirs. Vacationers with cameras, sunburn and easy smiles, not knowing the water was stripping more than timber. Local news set up, a reporter from KCNR. Can we get a word, Chief Walker? He smiled, shoved his hands deep in his pockets, and looked to thread his way through when the people gasped. Fragmented noise as the roof caved and crashed to the water below. Piece by piece, the foundation lay crude and skeletal, like the home was no more than a house. It had been the Fairlawn place since Walk could remember, a half acre from the ocean when he was a kid. Taped off a year back, the cliff was eroding. Now and then the people from California Wild came and measured and estimated. The stir of cameras and indecent excitement as slates rained and the front porch clung.
George Newbern, narrating We Begin at the End by Chris Whittaker, which is available commercially. Well, B.A. Paris, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsail, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.